Well, hello, superstars, and welcome back to another episode of Word Up with Danny Katz. Today I am joined by Mark Gober. Mark Gober is well known in the quote-unquote truther space for the 7 books he has published, all deconstructing different levels and layers of consensus reality. I was so excited to have Mark on the show. I've wanted to dive in deep with him since meeting him at Confluence last year, and our conversation proved just as delightful as I knew it would be. Before we dive into today's conversation, I am reminding you to click that subscribe button, to like, to share, to comment, to send this episode to at least 3 friends, because sharing is caring and caring is awesome. Also, inviting you to leave a review as you are listening on some sort of audio podcast platform. Those reviews really go a long way in convincing the algorithm to give us more reach. Also, reminding you to sign up for my newsletter at dannykatz.com. It's the very best way to ensure that we stay in touch and to stay abreast of my every next book drop, course drop, live event, and product drop, because the only place I am announcing those is through said newsletter. Lastly, I would like to invite you to check out Brain Supreme. If you have not checked out Brain Supreme's line of herbal microdosing products, may I encourage you to do so. I had some of their genius blend before my conversation with Mark today, and I will say I definitely feel an uptick in my focus, in my cognitive abilities. I don't feel any of that weird jitteriness that sometimes comes along with some microdosing products. I am a huge fan of their performance blend, which I take before playing racquetball or hitting like a really intense workout. I am a huge fan of the Brain Supreme line of products, and so I am encouraging you to check them out by way of the link in this show description. Be sure to use the code WORDUP, all one word, to nab 15% off anything and everything you order from Brain Supreme. All right, that does it for housekeeping. Buckle up and prepare to enjoy my conversation with Mark Gober. Mark Gober, how's it going, my friend?
I'm great, Danny. Thank you for having me.
It is something I've been looking forward to for a while. I've been like compiling notes on the side. Like, I have a little Mark Gober file. I'm like, add this, add this, add this. And I know you're making all the podcast rounds right now because of the Flat Earth book that you put out.
Yeah, An End to the Upside Down Cosmos is probably the one I'm speaking about most these days, but it really depends on the podcast host. There's still podcast hosts who want to talk about my first book on consciousness. It really just depends.
Cool. Awesome. How's the new book doing?
It seems like it's doing pretty well. I mean, in general, my book sales tend to be relatively slow.
Okay.
So it's hard for me to gauge, but from the people I've heard from, the feedback's been good.
Awesome. Do you like surprise yourself when you write your books?
I surprise myself in hindsight because, like, I never expected to write any of these books. And even after I write one, the subsequent topics are not things that I necessarily would have predicted I'd write about. So, like, when I saw you at Confluence last year, April 2024, I was not working on a book on cosmology.
Okay.
Nor was that really on my radar as a possibility.
Mm-hmm.
And here we are. That book is out.
Does your publisher ever give you grief on rubbing up against so many consensus narratives?
I'm really lucky with my publisher, Waterside Productions. I have to give them a lot of credit because when I first started, my book was about consciousness as something not produced by the brain. So the evidence for psychic abilities and the afterlife, survival of consciousness when the body dies. And they were on board with that. They've published many books in that area. So Eckhart Tolle, for example, is an author they've represented, Neil Donald Walsh. So it's kind of in their wheelhouse, but it's still very much a challenge to mainstream scientific thinking.
Right.
And then as my books have gotten progressively, I don't know, I guess more controversial, I've written about voluntarism, the idea that we shouldn't have compulsory political monopolies, i.e. government or UFO phenomenon or the World Economic Forum, medicine. Each time they've stuck with me and they've basically said, this is professionally done. Let's go. And each time I send a manuscript, I'm never sure what they're going to think.
Right.
There's this part of me that's nervous that says, well, maybe I went too far. They're not going to want to publish because I don't give warning. I mean, these books come quickly in terms of when I decide I'm going to write them. And then there's a process that unfolds very quickly where I realize I'm going to write a book. I do it as fast as I can in terms of getting a manuscript. I get it together for my publisher and then I cross my fingers basically. And it's worked out so far.
What do you think your secret sauce is? Like, why do you think that they're allowing such controversial intel to slip through the publishing cracks?
It's a smaller publishing house, so there's much more independence there. The organization Waterside Productions was founded by Bill Gladstone, and he made all the decisions. He passed away, sadly, about a year and a half ago. So his wife took over, who's become a good friend of mine as well. So basically, it's been Bill and Gail running Waterside, and they have the ability to publish what they want. And they happen to be legitimate truth seekers, very open-minded people. They know me well. They know what I'm trying to do with these books, which is to get people thinking, not necessarily knowing the answers, but to just share and synthesize information. So we've been on the same wavelength so far.
That's awesome. So it seems like so that you've written seven books and they're all the end of upside down blank. Is that accurate?
That's accurate. And also, I didn't come up with the title. For my first book, I sent the manuscript to Bill Gladstone and he said, I love it. This is going to be the title of the book, An End to Upside Down Thinking. And then I used that to an end to upside down living, an end to upside down liberty. Bill had worked on many things like this. So he published the initial For Dummies book, like it was DOS for Dummies. So he's familiar with that kind of thing and
Got
Chicken
it.
Soup for the Soul. He was involved in that in some way. I don't remember exactly how. So he had the foresight as because when I wrote my first book, I was still working in Silicon Valley. And to me, it was a side project that I was passionate about, but I didn't know I would write more books. He knew what was going on a bigger level, that things are upside down.
Yep.
So credit to him. And then I realized, oh, there's this other thing I want to write about. An end to upside down living makes sense. So I've come up with the title, like the last word, ever since the
Yep.
first one. But yes, you're right, Danny. That's been the theme is that I look at things that I paradigms that were all taught to be true. And then I realize, there's a lot of issues with that paradigm. And that becomes the subject of the book.
And is that a lens of perception that you've developed over time? Have you always been a contrarian, kind of deconstructing consensus reality?
I probably the tendency has been within me, like the capacity's been there, but I was always, especially growing up and in college in the business world, I was so focused on trying to achieve whatever was in front of me. It probably took away from that way of thinking. Although I have to say, in my last job where I became a partner at a firm called Sherpa Technology Group in Silicon Valley, and one of the things we focused on was intellectual property and patented technologies in particular, meaning these are inventions that, by definition, if a patent is granted, it's novel and non-obvious. That's how the patent is granted. So each patent is going against the mainstream in some way. I worked with many clients that were challenging the mainstream. Some of them were very big companies who were not challenging the mainstream that much. They were in some ways, they were innovating, but I also worked with smaller companies that were going up against major industries. And I saw what happened to them, where the major industries would really go after them and they would sometimes intentionally infringe upon the patents, at least as far as we could tell. And they would say, basically, sue me, good luck. And they could use the media, they could manipulate the world in the ways they needed to. So I saw that lens, and I was enthused by working for the little guy, especially when I got to know the inventors. And I said, wait, they invented something really important. This isn't fair. Why are these big companies taking their stuff? So in that sense, Danny, I probably developed or maybe started to harness that inner contrarian part of myself. But I can even remember back to when I was a kid or let's say going through college that I had questions metaphysically about who are we and why are we here? Like, why does any of this stuff matter? And what I concluded as I was learning more about what science taught us, is that we live in a random and meaningless universe, which I don't
Okay.
believe now, but at least I was thinking about those things. So when I would live my life, I had that backdrop consciously there of like, well, none of this matters. Why do people care so much about life? Why do I care so much? Because I do, but it doesn't make sense for me to care because we're all going to die. It doesn't matter. So I think that there was an existential part of me probably that, again, I didn't harness it as much as I probably could have because I was so focused on achieving. And
Right.
then through my professional life, and then also working in New York during the financial crisis of 2008, I didn't see anything too crazy, but just being in that environment and feeling the energy of it, there's probably a lot of my experiences that have made me prone to questioning narratives.
Okay. I scoured the internet and I could not find your birthday. I have to know
Interesting.
what your sign is.
What's your guess, Danny?
Well, you feel like an Aquarius, but I've also seen you get along well with others, so I feel like you're probably less antisocial than an Aquarius, but you have a heady nature, so maybe a Libra, but you're also prone to like high-minded ideas, so maybe Sag.
January 11th. So
Capricorn.
Capricorn Sun, Virgo Rising, Aquarius Moon.
Oh, interesting.
With four planets in Capricorn.
Wow. So you know best. You're always right.
Apparently.
But Capricorns get shit done, like in a real, I feel like Capricorns are the most like you can count on Capricorns. Like I'm not surprised hearing that you've published seven books. Capricorns do stuff like that.
It seems to align for sure.
Yeah. Have you tuned into your astrology? Like, is that a cosmology that resonates with you?
Definitely. And different readers will have different takes, of course. And some focus more on the progress charts, meaning where are the planets now, not just when you were born.
Right.
And because we do evolve. So, yeah, definitely. I'm interested in all that, including human design and gene keys, all of those things to try to understand the self better. I'm interested in. I have questions. I mean, I don't know as much about that stuff in terms of how do we actually get to the charts and what are the assumptions underlying that. And there's a difference between Western and Vedic, for example. So those nuances are beyond what I've looked into, but I have found a lot of resonance with what astrologers have read from my charts or other practitioners.
Do you know the primary numbers from your like human design gene keys chart? Like if you're a 5-1, a 3-2,
Yeah, 1-3 generator.
1-3 generator. Okay.
All centers defined except throat.
Oh, interesting. Okay. And I guess that makes sense why you write your book so quickly with that Virgo rising. You probably have like a very clear system and methodology of how you do it.
It's turned into that. I mean, a lot of what I do with the books, I feel like I was trained to do professionally, especially in my firm in Silicon Valley, because I would have to take in a lot of technical information on all kinds of technologies in a variety of industries and then synthesize it so that a board of directors could understand it. So there was a methodology in terms, I guess, in terms of just knowing how to take in information and pick out the points that are most important and then try to dumb down the language as much as possible so that people can actually take it in. I would say that's the general method. I've now seen, having done multiple books, there's a process for sure, which is months or in some cases years of research, because for the seventh book, some of the things I was talking about in that book came from the first book. And it's usually a deep dive to understand what everyone is saying about all aspects of the subject matter. So the one on cosmology, I wanted to understand what is the globe model, what is mainstream cosmology, what do people say who are challenging mainstream cosmology, what are the challenges on both sides. And I order basically every book I can find on Amazon on the subject. I listen to podcasts after podcasts, and I get to a point of saturation where I say, I don't know everything that's going on here, but I feel like I've encountered the main categories and the main arguments and counter arguments. And when I get to that point of saturation, I think to myself, why don't I try to put this in an outline? And especially the last two books, An End to Upside Down Medicine, which challenges the germ theory of disease and virology, in addition to other things, and An End to the Upside Down Cosmos. Both of those, I went into the writing process not being sure if this was going to be a book.
Okay.
Because I wasn't, it was, it sounded too far out there for me. Even though I had come across compelling research, I wasn't sure if I could create a book that would be compelling enough that I could actually put my name on, that I would submit to my publisher and feel good about it. So the writing process in those two cases was a bit of an exercise of like, I think this is what the book would look like. Let's see if it's compelling enough after I write it. And when I write it, I start with an outline and it's handwritten, where I basically know the structure of the book. Maybe it'll change by the end, but generally I know the categories of things I want to talk about and what the flow will be. And I just start from the beginning. I'll be like, okay, this is the introduction. And I'll sit there and I have books all over the place and my notes from all the different podcasts I've listened to. And I try to get that done. And then I go to bed and I think, oh, this is what chapter one's about. How am I possibly going to write this? And then I just force my way through. I go back to into investment banking mode and think, I've got to finish this book as fast as I can. So then somehow that happens. Chapter one's done. And that's the same thing where it seems to flow seamlessly each day in ways that I can't explain very well. And the book writing process is typically in the range of 2 weeks plus or minus. And when I say writing, I'm talking typing. To me, the writing's really in the research, but when I'm sitting there typing, it is painful because I'm just going all day nonstop. Now I figured out there's a method of making sure I eat at certain times because otherwise I wouldn't, making sure I work out. I will cut myself off at a certain time when I feel like I'm not fully functional. Like I'll make sure I get sleep. So that's the basic process.
So there's an aspect of me that wants to like wring your neck through the computer because I'm like, it only takes you 2 weeks of torture. For me, my last book was like 5 years. When you're in the process, do you have that thing that some writers have where you're like constantly obsessed and you're constantly thinking about it? And even though you're having other conversations, the book is there, like, give me your attention, come write me. Do you have that?
Totally. Totally. That starts for me in the research phase. When I'm actually writing the book as in typing it out, I'm not doing much else. And I can't really do much else until it's done. And then once the first draft of the manuscript is done, I clean it up a little bit, then it goes to my publisher. And then when the publisher gives a green light, then I can't really, I have a hard time doing much else other than the final editing, working with the proofreader, getting the audiobook done. So I maybe compress that whole process into a few weeks or months total. And there's a part of me that feels like I cannot relax until everything has been submitted to my publisher for final submission. And then when it's finally done, I can kind of exhale. What I find is that one thing I do is I don't publish the book until I've read the audiobook because I'll catch things that I like to change. Like, oh, sometimes I'll catch typos or just things that I'm like, well, maybe this needs a sentence in between. When I actually read every word, that helps. But as I'm going through that process and leading up to the audiobook or during the audiobook, I'll get these insights, sometimes in the middle of the night, sometimes at random points where I say, I need to change that word, or let me check that footnote. And then all of a sudden at the very end, it's like the faucet turns off and there's nothing that I feel like I need to do anymore. And that's how I know it's done.
And then you're at peace.
Yeah, I would say so. I mean, there's usually nervousness, especially with the last few books of like, did I miss something big? Am I going to publish this and they're going to think I'm totally crazy? And what I found is the opposite largely is that it's the books have opened doors and it's been a form of liberation for me. And a lot of people have either agreed or they didn't know they agreed and then they read the book and said, oh, okay, now I'm thinking about this differently. So I'd say in general, the feedback has been positive and that helps calm me down. Although writing the books really is not about other people as I go into myself. It's about my own passion in the moment of producing something that I think is important to produce. And then when it's done, it's sort of part of the past. It's like old news.
I get that. And I get that from my background as a journalist, where like to dive really deep into a topic for a short period of time, become obsessed, and then be done with it and like barely remember what it was even about.
Yeah.
Because your book seemed to be so much about deconstruction, is there like a part of you that needs to know what the answer is? Like, I've heard you say on a number of podcasts or even in the talks around like the shape of the planet that you don't really know, or even deconstructing, the fallacy of germ theory. But then, at least for me, like, I haven't found a narrative that explains why multiple people in the same area will express the same symptoms. So is there a part of you that needs to know, well, then why does this work? Or are you comfortable and okay in the like, well, all this is wrong and I don't know what the answer is?
I feel comfortable now in the I don't know. I mean, there's a part of me that's curious, but also as a someone who's putting out this information publicly, it's a much safer position to look at the specific claims that science puts forth or that governments put forth and to deconstruct them and to show where there are flaws or logical fallacies. Because that is something that we can definitely do. To come up with an alternative theory that's comprehensive, that can explain everything, that's much more difficult and perhaps impossible because we're basing whatever theory we come up with on the limitations of our current knowledge. And there's so much that we don't know about science and medicine and cosmology, and a lot of it's guesswork and guessing with models. So, for example, with regard to cosmology, there's a popular movement known as ether cosmology, or bringing back this notion of ether, which was regarded as the fifth element. And it might be considered like a spiritual interface. And when you excite the ether, then that you'll have different types of matter or different types of light, for example. But everything that we perceive in the world is just a manifestation of ether. And that can explain a lot of phenomena well. It can explain certain observations in the late 1800s, experiments in physics like Airy's failure, which some would call Airy's success, or the Michelson-Morley study of 1887. People have wanted to bring back the ether to explain the results of those studies. I'm totally open to that, but I'm also not sure because it's this etheric thing by definition. We can't even point to it. So it's nice as a framework to try to explain phenomena, but I'm not even comfortable saying with certainty that we know how that works. So there are just too many question marks that we're trying to come up with theories of the world based on limited knowledge. So I am more and more comfortable with I don't know.
And when you say it's a safer approach, is that like a conscious strategy of yours to approach your books in such a way that you're going to generate the least amount of pushback?
There is part of me that wants to be as safe as possible for myself, but also give the reader permission to explore these alternative possibilities. Because naturally, what happens is when an existing model has clearly been falsified or shown not to be solid, the mind goes to, well, then what is true?
Right.
So it gives the reader permission in a way that I found seems to be helpful. Because then, if you start off with cosmology, for example, saying Earth is flat, that is too confronting for some people to even acknowledge. But what I'm finding is if they challenge the spinning globe model and they see there are fundamental problems in physics that we can't really overcome, they're open to saying, well, I'm not sure what it is. Maybe it's not a spinning globe. Maybe it's a topographical plane in some way. That might not have been a position they would ever consider. So it's partially for me and also my training of wanting to have everything cited that if I'm making a claim, then I want people to know where it came from. Or if I'm making an inference, I want them to know it's an inference. So there's that conservative part of me that's been ingrained from business because if I've made the mistake before of making mistakes and it's not pleasant. So I touched the hot stove enough times to try to, that my instinct is to want to be conservative. But also I want, I'm very conscious of not misleading people or not wanting to mislead people. My concern there is, at the highest level, a spiritual concern of like, what are the karmic implications of leading someone to believe something that's not true and then them making mistakes in their life on that basis? Are there consequences for the, to the, to my soul for doing that? So I don't want to do that in the event that that's a real thing, that misleading people could be harmful to the soul.
Is that a perspective that you've always had? Have you had this spiritual karmic attunement your whole life?
No, it started roughly 9 years ago, summer of 2016. Prior to that, I was more of an atheist, agnostic. I thought life was random and meaningless. When we die, it's lights out. And I started in 2016 to come across research that countered that idea on the science of consciousness, both anecdotal accounts and then peer-reviewed papers and books. And I realized there was this whole body of evidence, which led me to look into things like karma, or what's the purpose of life? Are there consequences to our actions? So that's a newer set of beliefs. I always did want to act morally and like to follow rules in that way. Like I kind of equated morality with following certain rules. So, and I wanted to treat people well, but I didn't have a deeper sense of meaning or purpose behind it beyond I thought it was the right thing to do. Now I think there is some kind of, some would call it the golden rule. I don't know. The way we act, or morality or natural law is embedded within the fabric of reality itself. There's something there that's actually built into this reality that we all inhabit, whether we like it or not. And that's very different than how I used to think.
Interesting. I just want to acknowledge, in case you're hearing the background noise, we're having a pretty loud hailstorm right now. So, in case you're hearing that, that is happening. Was there an inciting incident in 2016 that turned you on to the realms of consciousness?
I could answer this in two ways. One is the condition of my life at the time that probably made me more receptive. And then secondly, actual information that shifted me. So the first category, which I would now call a dark night of the soul, or in astrological terms, they would call it a Saturn return. I was 30 and I really didn't have a clear sense of where my life was going. There were some business deals that I was working on that didn't go the way that I wanted, some relationships that didn't work out. And I didn't have a sense of meaning or purpose behind all of it. And I'm like, why have I been on this treadmill for so long? What am I doing here? So I felt like a zombie, even though most people around me would say, Mark, your life is pretty good. Internally, I felt like a zombie. And I could trace that back to a few years before it, where that process started to hit. But in 2016, I was feeling that strongly. And it probably made me more open to listening to podcasts, for example. That's something I started to do in 2016 that I wasn't doing before. And at the time, podcasts were not as big as they are now. It was a bit newer. And because I was in Silicon Valley, there was more of that kind of energy. And people were listening to the Tim Ferriss show, for example. So I had friends sending me episodes on with Tim Ferriss. And he was dealing with not only business issues, which I found interesting, but also personal development issues. And I learned about sensory deprivation float tanks, for example, which I started to do. You sit in a pod with salt water, and there's so much salt that the body floats. And I'd close the pod, there'd be no lights, no sound, and you're just floating. It's like meditation on steroids. So who knows what that did, but I would do hours of floating just because I heard about it and I heard that it could alter the brain in positive ways. So there was this curiosity, and it led me to alternative health shows, including a show called Extreme Health Radio, which is still on the air, and I actually have been on it now since. But these are people who were using things outside of allopathic medicine to treat themselves, people curing themselves of cancer and all sorts of things that I thought were very interesting. And I remember just I was listening to the podcast in order, and the next one up one day was a woman named Laura Powers, who is a professional psychic, basically, and works with interdimensional beings and what she calls angels. And I'm like, wait, I just heard these hosts who are pretty serious people, and they're taking her seriously? Like, what's going on here? Are they all delusional? Are they lying somehow? And then I ended up listening to Laura's own podcast. It's called Healing Powers, and the episodes are pretty short. I used to have a long drive from San Francisco down to Silicon Valley, so I had hours in the car every day, and I would just crank through her episodes. I listened to every single one from 2016 back to 2011. And I realized it was person after person describing this view of reality, that there is a spiritual dimension. And I couldn't reason at a certain point that they were all lying, or they certainly weren't all colluding because they had different backgrounds. And there were probably some more than others that affected me. One that comes to mind is an interview with Paul Davids that Laura had done many years before 2016. Paul is also a Princeton graduate, so I perked up when I heard that, and he was in the psychology department like me. So I'm like, okay, what's going on here? He's a Hollywood producer, like of the Transformers, so pretty prominent in the Hollywood area, like credible. And he was working on a film called The Life After Death Project and was speaking to Laura about that and how his deceased colleague passed away. And then there were many strange incidences that occurred where basically it seemed like his co deceased colleague was communicating with him. Even one incident where Paul was in his home in New Mexico by himself, and he had papers that he was working on. He left the room and he came back, and there was ink that crossed out certain words on the paper, and the ink blot was wet, and he didn't put it there, and no one else was in the house. So he then sent the ink to chemistry labs, and the chemists were unable to understand the composition. Like, there was something strange about the composition of this ink. And that was one example out of many that he described. So there were these examples like this of people that I found to be credible in other ways who were speaking seriously about the possibility of there being more to life than meets the eye. And when I heard more and more of those, I got to a point of no return, basically, where I said, there's too much here that I can't dismiss every piece of evidence. Maybe on an individual basis, I could say, well, th there are these other explanations for it. But when after coming across enough cases, and reading the peer-reviewed research, seeing declassified documents from the CIA talking about remote viewing, for example, which is sending the mind far away in space and time, and the documents saying this is a real phenomenon, and things like that over and over again. Princeton University, where I was at undergrad, there was a lab there that I didn't know about called the Engineering Anomalies Research Lab, run by Dr. Robert John, who was the dean of engineering. He was studying psychic phenomena. I had no idea about this, and he was getting results showing that this is real. Or the Institute of Noetic Sciences, which I've joined the board of, and has 50 years worth of peer-reviewed research. And I'm looking at these papers, and it was actual research. And in some cases, I think the research is more rigorous than in normal science because the skeptics come out so hard against the findings that the scientists, for the sake of their own reputation, they have to be more rigorous with the methodologies, and often they have to leave academia because it's such a toxic environment there. If you study anything outside the mainstream, often you can't get tenure. It's very bad for your reputation. So I was seeing all these dynamics of like, okay, there's too much evidence for me to dismiss on the whole. The analogy I like to use is if you have a bundle of twigs, you could break any individual twig, but the whole bundle will remain intact. And I was getting this really big bundle where I could pick at some twigs, but the bundle was too big. And then I was also seeing these dynamics of suppression of science and demeaning scientists, even though they were doing legitimate work. And you're going on Wikipedia, Rupert Sheldrake, for example, and the first sentence, at least last time I checked, they're calling him a pseudoscientist. This is stuff that I saw in the business world. When a company or inventor had a major technology that was going to transform an industry, those people would be demeaned and their technology would be stolen and the media could be weaponized. So I saw this pattern before and I'm like, okay, I can see what's happening here. I need to rethink my whole life. And that's where this whole process started for me.
Okay, there was a lot there. And thank you for that. So, when you saw this type of suppression happening in the business world, would you speak to it? Did it change your perspective on the work you were doing at that time?
I spoke to it in that I was working with my clients to help them in whatever capacity I could. Sometimes it was with their public relations. Sometimes, if they were involved in patent litigation, for example, if they believed someone was infringing on their patents, helping them in the process and working with the lawyers to help people understand what was going on in the litigation. And there was definitely a spark I felt ignited in myself in those cases where I felt like there was an injustice. And I became obsessed with those clients. And I was doing whatever I could, but that felt more than just business to me. It felt like there was a higher purpose, even though I didn't have a sense of meaning or purpose. In hindsight, I can see that there was something driving me where I'd want to stay up really late to help these clients because I felt like, well, they just changed the world. They just revolutionized technology. They invented it 15 years ago, and now everyone's stealing their technology. That's not right. And these companies are making money, and this company's not, and the media is saying bad things about them. I saw that pattern, and now we see that everywhere.
Was that perspective valued, lauded, tolerated in the Silicon Valley world?
Well, certainly among my colleagues, and I give credit to my colleagues at Sherpa, they were very open-minded, even open-minded when my first book came out. But I was still at my firm, and Upside Down Thinking was published while I was still there. So there was a part of them that was very supportive, and they saw the same thing I did of like these companies were inventing important things. They should be able to defend that, or there should be some justice here. But outside of that, I think people had a hard time. One of the issues with this question is that a lot of what I did was confidential. So not people wouldn't necessarily know everything I was doing. Some of the public companies, if they were publicly traded, they would mention that they hired my firm, or they'd mention the people involved, like me or my colleagues, but they wouldn't necessarily know about some of the projects I was working on. Of the ones I was working on, there's one in particular I can think of. If people heard that I was working with that company, the reaction would be like, what? Like that's a fraudulent company, and they're just out there to get money from the big companies. So they would typically take on the mainstream narrative. And I saw the way that that mindset or that mind control or the use of language, as you're so expert in, was being manipulated.
And did that, well, let me go back. So, I mean, it seems like, and I don't obviously don't know the specifics of your childhood, but it seems like a sort of like traditional, like high-minded achievement path. You went to an Ivy League university, You were a captain of the tennis team. You went into finance, Silicon Valley, like achievement. So was there, like, as you begin to unravel your own worldview, and then as you begin to go public with like letting the world know where we've gotten things wrong, was there pushback in your social circles? Was there pushback in your family?
Definitely. All the above at different times for different subjects. My first book, when I wrote the manuscript of An End to Upside Down Thinking, I had a number of friends read it. One in particular pulled me aside and said, "Mark, I read it. We've got to talk one-on-one." And his comments were, "I'm your friend. You cannot publish this book. People are going to think you're crazy." So there
Okay.
was a little bit of that, even with the first book, which is arguably the least controversial.
Did that land with you? Did you have a concern around that?
I was frustrated and partially concerned. I'm like, this guy just read the whole book, and I don't care how many hundreds of citations there were, it clearly did not get through to him. His arguments, though, once we started to talk, were things like the statistics are too good for these psychic phenomena. They can't be real. The scientists must have made it up.
Okay.
So I didn't think the arguments were very good that he made, but it made me concerned because I realized it doesn't matter what I say, that there will be people who are going to be upset with this.
Yep.
And I've had to encounter that throughout each part of the process. I think the book that caused me the most concern was the third one, An End to Upside Down Liberty, published in
Okay.
2021. It was my first foray into the political world and even the economic world. The first two were much more spiritual, scientific, philosophical. This was a book about political and economic theory,
Okay.
and also tying it into the things that were happening in the world in the era of COVID,
Yep.
which you remember how polarized things were then. I mean, now it's polarized, but in 2021, it was insane. And I was coming from a world where I personally didn't have political beliefs prior to 2020. Or if I did, I didn't know them because I just didn't care about politics. I was
Okay.
completely ignorant. It was not something I ever cared about. Unless there was a legislation that affected business, then I would care. And I would only care
Okay.
in that particular instance. So I didn't know the difference between Democrats and Republicans,
Did
seriously.
you vote? Did you identify as either?
No.
Okay.
I just didn't even care.
Got it.
Well, I think when I was, I forget how old I was, maybe 18 in college, I voted just because I thought we were supposed to vote. And then that was the end of me. And because I just didn't care. And
Yep.
so 2020 happened, and I realized there was a split among people that I respected, especially because I had written so much about spiritual philosophy and spiritual thinking and the science of it. There, most of the people I would say that I would have agreed with prior to 2020, they went hard left in 2020. When everything happened. So, meaning they were advocating for major COVID restrictions, mask wearing, very in favor of the injections, very in favor of social issues that I just thought were insane, the positions they were taking. And I was so confused. Like, wait, these people are very adept in one area. What's going on here? I don't agree with them. So did I get everything wrong in those other places? Or I need to have an opinion on these things because I don't align with them. So that led me down the rabbit hole of looking into what is the nature of government, generally speaking, which led me to the path of looking at voluntarism and the Austrian School of Economics. But that's a long preface to this book, An End to Upside Down Liberty, published in the fall of 2021. I knew what that book could do in terms of dividing my existing audience and even cannibalizing the audience of people that liked me before who would say, "Mark, you're crazy."
Right.
Mark went off the deep end. And that certainly did happen for some people. Of course, it led me into new paths that are awesome, but I lost some people with that book. And for some reason, it really affected me. Affected me even before the publication. The nerves I had before that publication were more than anything else. Also, I think there's more danger in talking about politics, especially speaking out against government itself.
Right.
There's more just inherent danger in taking that kind of stance. So that was newer for me. I mean, there's maybe some danger in challenging science, but this felt like next level, and I just wasn't sure what was going to happen or how people were going to handle it. But
And
yeah.
were you attuned to, for lack of a better phrase, conspiracy theories before you started tackling these books?
No.
And so let's take the third book and then to Upside Down Liberty. Did it rock your worldview? Like, did it shake you what your research was showing you as you were writing that book?
Yeah, definitely did because I had never I had never considered government as an inherently oppressive entity. I had taken the position unconsciously, which is the one we're all taught since grade school, that the government is an entity designed to protect the people. So that was a big shift for me to look at it as something actually predatory organization. And I would say even one that violates natural law and is inherently incompatible with spiritual principles. That's the take that's what I take and describe in the book. But as I went down that path, looking at the darkness of, let's say, the darkest things I've come across, such as satanic ritual abuse, and the fact that powerful people are involved in that and have been throughout human history, arguably, when we look at various records, even the Bible describes that sort of thing, that there might be ancient, highly sophisticated evil that is more evil than most people could imagine because they couldn't conceive of doing these sorts of things, and that it seems to exist on a spiritual dimension. That was very difficult for me, and I would have to stop myself from the research at a certain point. There's only so much one can take of listening to how people are tortured. And so I would go into it because I said, I need to understand this. Wait, why do all these people who are so spiritual, they're just talking about unconditional love and they're not talking about this? Like, that's really bad. So there's this part of me, like the part of me that doesn't like injustice. I was wanting to go into the depths of evil, and that was my first exposure to it, and it did rock my world for sure.
Did you, when they, I call it fovid because I just don't like the coding in the word. I don't like to run those frequencies through my body. But when that hit the news, early 2020, did you buy into it at all? Were you immediately, oh, okay.
I did. Yeah. So let's say late February, early March 2020, I remember seeing people out in restaurants and bars in San Francisco and thinking, what are they doing? They're all going to die. And I wanted to wear a mask if I went into a store. But then I was watching the alternative media, and that quickly disappeared when I realized what was going on. And I saw the censorship of doctors. There was one in particular, I can't remember his name, who was in an ER facility in California. And he did a press conference saying, yeah, people are getting sick, but it's not as bad as what the media is claiming. And then he was taken off YouTube. And I'm like, okay, this is not what we're told. So I recovered quickly, but I was believing what I heard. I didn't have a reason to question at that point.
So, in the times that I've seen you, at these festivals that we've attended, I see you as a bit of an anomaly because you come off as more conservative, less unhinged than the rest of us. Like one foot in what some would call normie world, one foot in weirdo world. So, had you until your first books, until Fovid, until the end of Upside Down Liberty, had you been someone who was embraced by consensus reality?
Probably. I mean, to some extent, when I left my job in New York, I worked at UBS, one of the large investment banks. That was totally in line with the mainstream to do that out of undergrad for me. Most of my classmates went into investment banking or strategy consulting. That's what people did in 2008 when I graduated. Some people went into tech or Facebook. That was a little more fringy. So I went right down the fairway. But then when I left investment banking and went to my firm that focused on like intellectual property as it relates to business, that was like me, like what's Mark doing, if you can imagine. That was very outside of the mainstream. So I guess that part of me has existed to some degree of like, oh yeah, Mark's doing some weird stuff with intellectual property, but he's still kind of in the business world. Obviously, not as big a leap as I've taken more recently, but maybe there's been a part of me that just never resonated with the mainstream and wanted to do something that felt like it was outside the mainstream. Because I saw this opportunity of, wait, there's going to be more and more innovation. And if you have rights to innovation, that will be inherently valuable. And I was just on Wall Street, and no one on Wall Street is thinking about this. So it seemed like this an opportunity and also something that might be more intellectually stimulating. So I was willing to make that shift. And I'm thinking back to my friends like in high school and college, and they probably would tell you that while I would do things that were part of the mainstream, I was a bit of a different thinker. Like one friend of mine, I'm just picturing him saying, like, where are you from? Even back in like college days or post college. So it's
Mm-hmm.
probably been in there, but then the success oriented, maybe Capricorn, I don't know, or Virgo part of me that just
Right.
had a goal, I would leave all that stuff out of, well, I've got to win this tennis match, or I need to get this job, or I need to help this client or get a good grade. Then I would do whatever I needed to do.
And so you don't happen to know where your Mars is, do you?
Scorpio.
Oh, powerful. Cool. Okay. And so as you're transitioning out of like mainstream finance and getting more and more fringe, you're like, have you lost friends? Have you been canceled? Like, are you enduring what a lot of us in the sort of music and sky confluence space have endured?
Short answer is yes. There are a lot of people that used to be closer friends that I'm just not as close with. I haven't had as much fighting, like one-on-one actual arguments, I think, as other people that I've spoken to, but I've just drifted because I haven't felt in alignment. And it's hard if you look at the world completely differently, where if I'm looking at something as benevolent and another person says that's evil, it's hard to relate. So I've just found myself drifting away. In terms of being canceled, I'm not huge on social media, but I do remember there were periods when I was definitely shadow banned. I could just see the numbers, even though they weren't big to begin with. And it feels to me like I'm just generally ignored. Like my stuff never on social media takes off very much. The books don't get out there that much. And because of that, I don't face as much resistance. Just feels like people are either aware of me and don't want to talk about it, or they're not aware of me at all.
And what about your family? How have they embraced your path?
I mean, different family members have different opinions. I mean, generally supportive in that they'll like give feedback before the book's published, not necessarily agreeing with everything. But I would say, generally speaking, friends and family have a more mainstream view of the world. So even if they find something that I'm doing interesting, it's not like they're going to leave their job in the way that I did and write books about it and change a whole life orientation. What I do find, however, is that when people have major life traumas, then they want to talk to me. Or
Interesting.
if something happens regarding life and death, the death of a family member, then they'll want to talk more. So it's like there needs to be an impetus for all this stuff to really hit home. Otherwise, as one friend said to me when my first book came out, classically trained doctor, he said, Mark, you might be right about this stuff, meaning the afterlife, spiritual dimensions, and so forth. You might be right about this, but my life is good the way it is, and I don't want to rock the boat, so I'm not going into any of this stuff. And what I find is that, I mean, my view, I understand where he's coming from. My view is that life will rock us into having to accept reality at some point. So it's better to get on board with it. And some people don't want to do that. But when life hits and these existential questions come up, people seem to want to talk more.
Yeah. I'm not surprised with that Mars and Scorpio. I so want to see your gene keys, but I'll push that off to the side for the moment. I'm one of my favorite teachers is Guru Singh, and he always says we're living in a one-room schoolhouse. And so recognizing for me is that this isn't necessarily everyone's incarnation to wake up. And some people have the luxury of being younger souls, and like maybe life isn't going to jostle them out of the various fictions that are propping up their lifestyles, and like wonderful for them if it's not something that needs to be, they don't need those rug pulls that the rest of us are enduring.
Yes, I have come to feel that way more and more. When my first book came out, I wanted to tell everyone, and I'd say, this is so life-changing. It's so important. Now I just put it out there, and when someone is ready, then it's there for them. I'm much more focused on my own internal development. So I agree with Guru Singh's perspective. And side note on him, I've never met him in person, but I, through a friend, got connected with him for my first book, and he was nice enough to write an endorsement blurb for an end upside down
Aww.
thinking.
It's so sweet. I absolutely adore Guru Singh. We were connected on through social media for years and years before. Actually, I don't know that we have actually ever met in person. He's been on my podcast a few times, but I went to the summer solstice retreat in Espanola way back in like 2011, and every bearded man wearing a turban I saw, I was like, "Are you Guru Singh? Are you Guru Singh?" None of them were ever Guru Singh, but there were plenty of bearded, turbaned men at that event. So I'm curious about your own spiritual development. I've also had like beautiful experiences in the float tank. It's where I do a lot of my unraveling of language because there's no obstructions. I just love being in that kind of nothingness and playing with language. How would you describe your spiritual path and like where are you in your internal development?
I would say my spiritual path is my primary focus. And books are a byproduct of my own spiritual process, meaning that I will look at a paradigm or a belief system that I used to buy into. And when I have a shift and think it's important enough, then I like sharing that with other people, but I'm really summarizing what's happening internally. There is a principle known as neti neti in the Vedic philosophy. And I've heard Dr. Tom Cowan mention this in the context of basically getting to truth. Neti neti means not this, not that. So it's like you get to the truth, not by starting with the truth, but by eliminating the falsehoods. And when you eliminate falsehoods, the set of possible truths becomes narrower and narrower. And it feels like that's a lot of my path. And then also just shedding, I mean, it's along the similar lines of shedding belief systems or patterns that don't align with my current life philosophy or my current orientation, but I might still be holding on to those beliefs. And maybe it's trapped in the body in some way, or it's on an unconscious level. So trying to unwind all of that. What I find, and my second book, An End to Upside Down Living, goes into this a bit more. It's about the spiritual journey. And I synthesize teachings from a lot of people that have influenced me and also talk a bit about my own journey at the time. That was 2020. People, when I studied spiritual awakenings for that book, there are many common patterns that people go through, whether it's in the modern era or throughout history. Even though the specifics of their journey might be different, there are challenges that people seem to overcome, meaning it's not a smooth path typically, because there are things people are holding on to that they don't necessarily want to let go of. And what I find is that life seems to bring us those challenges, or it brings us opportunities to see those areas. And it's up to us whether we want to continue on a path that could lead to more suffering, or change our behavior and or thinking and do it differently this time. And what I find is that life will bring it to us. And sometimes it might start off in a subtle way, and it gets louder and louder if we don't listen to it. And it could conclude with something that you'd call a dark night of the soul, or something that leads to physical harm, or an illness, or some tragedy. But it's something that will jar the system enough to then have to rethink those belief systems and or change a lifestyle. But
That does it for the first half of today's conversation with Mark Gober, as you are inspired to tune into the second half of our deep diving all over the place intellectual exploration. You can find that on both my Locals and Patreon communities. Those addresses are dannycats.locals.com and patreon.com/dannycats. At both of those communities, for as little as $5 a month, you get access to all of my second half conversations, plus that warm, fuzzy, yummy, tingly feeling that comes along with supporting me in keeping on keeping on. Your support really truly means the world and encourages me slash resources me to continue doing these podcasts, putting out video content. So thank you for supporting me at one or both of those platforms at whatever tier feels most aligned for you. Giving you a full lay of the land, while $5 a month gets you access to all of my second half conversations, $10 a month gets you access to my Words with Danny and Emily podcast, which is our deep scorched earth conspiracy show that Emily and I have been doing for more than 8 years, and which is available for subscribers only. Just wanted you to have a full scope of the offering so that you can choose whichever tier of monthly support feels most aligned for you. One last reminder to sign up for my newsletter at dannykatz.com and to scope out the Brain Supreme product line. They are my very, very favorite microdosing products right now. Their formulations are really nuanced and intelligent. They have just the right amount of tonic herbs, of special ingredients to either amp up our cognition, amp up our moods, amp up our athletic performance. You can scope out their whole line by way of the link in the show description. And be sure to use the code WORDUP, all one word, to nab 15% off anything and everything you order from Brain Supreme. You are so welcome, tribe. That does it. Thank you so much for sharing your sacred attention with me. Thank you for remembering that every word matters, that you are omniscopic amazingness. I will see you over on the Locals and the Patreon. Have a rockin' day.